killed in Bloomington Normal in the last 2 months. There have been also numerous lesser shooting incidents. Federal prosecutors announced arrests and indictments this week of 15 members of the gang, the Bomb Squad, in Peoria for a variety of serious crimes, including several murders, one of them in April, a Bradley University student who was a bystander. With us to talk about the issues surrounding gun violence are the Reverend William Bennett, City of Refuge Ministries pastor and member of the Bloomington Public Safety and Community Relations Board, the PSCRB, Rick Bleichner, the police chief of the town of Normal, Karen Irvin from Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, the local chapter, and Alan Chambers, a community leader. Gun violence now, of course, is not just a central Illinois problem. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there are approximately 81,300 non-fatal injuries and more than 31,600 deaths every year in the U.S. involving guns. Let's start with our panelists assessing how you see the situation in our community. Is the latest string of fatalities an aberration, a natural outgrowth of a rise in lesser shooting incidents? Just what? And let us start with Karen Irvin.
Thank you, Charlie. I am not surprised in the fact that Moms Demand Action is a new group. We started this local group about 3.5 months ago. And so I'm a co-lead with Diane White, and we have been learning as much as we can about gun violence. And one of the things we have learned is one of the stats that Charlie just said, that 96 people a day in our country are killed with gun violence. So we are formed to advocate for stronger gun laws and policies, trying to reduce gun violence. We understand and we support the Second Amendment. That's one thing we like to put out there right away about our group, as we're new and people are learning who we are. That we feel that we can support the Second Amendment while doing so much to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. And I know we're going to be talking more about locally the violence that recently has been going on, and how many of the weapons are those that have been stolen from unsecured areas. And that is one of the missions of Moms Demand Action, is to advocate for education for gun owners on how the responsibility is theirs to secure their guns. And we are also working legislatively. That's our main issue. We feel that's our lane, that we are directly involved with trying to advocate for the gun laws that we think make sense, that gets bipartisan support. And I think that the violence that we have had locally here has really alerted a lot of people to this problem that we're going to hear a lot about tonight.
Thank you, Karen. Alan Chambers, where do you see the root of this latest cluster of tragedies coming from?
You really can't call, I can't say a root. For the simple fact, it's all over the board. It's not just in one situation. So I can't pinpoint and say it's this or it's that, because it's all over. And that's the bad part about it. Got to figure out how, not just to get the guns out their hands, but why are they getting them? That's the problem that we need to figure out. Why? You know what I mean? It's a thing that we need to stop, is why are they getting them? You know what I mean? That's most gun violence that takes place is because a problem transpired. And one way or another, if we can alleviate that problem that transpired, then it's a possibility that we can stop a little bit of gun violence in our area.
Chief Rick Bleichner, what is intelligence gathering showing you about gun violence in our cities?
I mean, we've had tragedies here in the last 2 months, what would typically take us years to, that this community would take to see for homicides. I can tell you that the potential's been there for a long time, and it's quieter than others, but there's always been individuals that are out there that are willing to carry guns. And I've said this before, there's a big difference between somebody carrying a gun and not carrying a gun. It's a big leap to go from every day, from just walking down the street and being in your social circles, And doing that without carrying a gun or feeling the need to carry a gun. Once you feel the need to carry a gun, that's a big step. Once you're carrying a gun then, and then you feel that you need to show that gun or to use that to influence people, to threaten people, to defend yourself, then that's a smaller leap. Then the next time you pull it out and point it at somebody is an even smaller leap. And so when we look at it, and everybody probably in this room that's sitting here and thinks it's not possible for us to sit and think how we could shoot somebody. But it comes in steps. And if you're at that point where you don't carry a gun, don't like guns, aren't around guns, yeah, that's something that's completely foreign to you. But if you're somebody that's your everyday life and you carry them, you're around them, and you use them as part of your influence or whether you feel you need to for protection or if that's your way of life, then shooting at somebody or shooting someone is a much smaller leap than what most of us would think. So what we see out there is there certainly are more guns that are out there. We see them carried by younger people. That doesn't mean, that you know, a whole range of people aren't carrying them age-wise. But we do see it now more and more. What used to be, you'd have a group of individuals, and they may have access to a gun or talk about wanting to have a gun. Now everybody wants a gun. Everybody wants a gun. They think that's the way to deal with it. And what I think we've seen as a bigger societal problem is the devaluing of human life. When we take out our differences with someone, we take and come up with the finality of shooting at somebody and hitting somebody over our differences. When you really boil it down to it, that certainly is no reason for anybody to lose their life, and that's the tragedy in it.
Reverend William Bennett, your thoughts on the origins of this problem?
Well, thank you for allowing me to be here, and even before answering that question, I do want to publicly offer my condolences to the families of the victims of the recent tragedies that we have had. I think the Second Amendment does give us the right to bear arms, but that right does not come without responsibility. And with the recent tragedies that have happened in our community, the first thing that I think about is it has to be unacceptable. Whether it was one death or seven or eight, doesn't matter how many, one is enough for us to all shout with one voice. That's unacceptable. Also, we have to recognize that we can't just look at it as a gang violence problem, an African American problem, a white people problem, this particular neighborhood problem. When things like this happen in our community, it has to be an everybody, everywhere problem. I also kind of feel, let me just say this real quick, that if we start at what do we need to do to stop it, then we're already late. It's already occurred. So I think we need to find proactive ways to figure out how do we cause it to never start.
Thank you, Reverend. Let's start and let's proceed with a question that was asked by a couple different people. Why are people choosing to carry guns? Why are they choosing to get them? We know nationally there are a third more guns than people in the United States. We know that at least 40% of all gun crimes are committed with stolen guns. Why are people keeping guns? Does anybody want to tackle that first?
Well, me personally, I think, well...
Thank you, Alan. Go ahead.
It's all different avenues, reason why people carry guns. Some carry guns for needs of protection. Some carry guns to need to threaten others. Some carry guns... It's all different types of reasons why people carry guns. The problem is not why they're carrying them, it's how they're using them while they're carrying them. That's where we're at right now, especially teenagers. That's my full focus. My focus is on the kids that's carrying the guns that has no right to actually carry a gun. But the thing is once again, is how is they getting this gun is the point I'm trying to continue to make. We got to figure out how, why, and then we can go to the next level.
Chief Bleichner, are you seeing changes in the age of people caught with guns?
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, we're seeing younger and younger individuals that are carrying firearms out there on the street. And, when that coupled with the fact of just the general hostilities that come with young individuals, it's a recipe for potential tragedy to happen. But yeah, that has been something we've seen. Like I said, not only are there more of them out there that we're recovering on the street, we're seeing individuals younger and younger ages that are choosing to carry those. And that is potentially deadly.
Alan, you had remarked after one of the recent shootings that this one hit me a little too close. Does that mean there have been others that have hit you close as well?
Well, every last one that has taken place, I've had the opportunity to know the child. Sometimes, I'm a chef by profession, so I've also had the opportunity to feed the child. Some of these kids have slept at my sister's house. Some of these kids have slept at my house. I've coached some of these kids. So yeah, it hit me really hard for the simple fact I've watched them grow up, especially in particular, like CJ, for instance. I watched him grow up from the age of 8 years old all the way. I've seen the changes he make, the bad choices. But the thing is, once again, is we do everything in town, not to knock any group or anything, we do everything in town for the youth, for what happens for the kids that's about to graduate high school. People forgetting CJ was a high school graduate. Everybody forgetting about that level, that 18 to 21, we forget about them, but them the kids that's actually at more danger than anybody else. Because we leave them out on their own, leave them to fend for themselves. Once you hit 18, we forget about you. You're an adult. You go do what you have to do, but that's the problem. We have no apprenticeship programs that you can get a kid in. We have no avenues for that. We had youth built, but that's up until you graduate. So that's where we're at. We need to find that something for these kids that's at these levels that's doing all this.
Reverend Bennett, you have a thought there.
I'm in agreement. I think a lot of times in dealing, when I've dealt with, first let me say that through these tragedies, I knew a lot of the people who were victims. I had family members who were affected. I had to eulogize one of the young ladies that was killed. Her mother was a member of my church before she moved to Iowa. So it does touch me in just the fact that my heart is for our youth, our young adult. And it does seem that sometimes we can lose touch with that generation. I'm dealing with a young man now who has been affected by these tragedies. He's suffering with depression. He's lost. When I looked into his eyes, I saw a loss of hope. And when our kids get to that place where they have a loss of hope, that's when it gets dangerous.
Yes.
That's when they don't need the gun in their hand, because they're already, and a lot of times we're going to look at the violence, but you have to understand, at least from my position as a pastor, I'm not just looking at them being violent. I'm wondering what's going on internally. And a lot of our children, our youth, are growing up with hurts and pains that no one is dealing with. Mm-hmm. And they get to a certain place where they lash out. With this young man, I saw no hope, no life in him. And I knew he's one angry moment away from making a terrible decision. And the sad thing is, he can get his hand on a gun, because there's a culture and there's a society that will allow you to. And one thing I did with that young man when I brought him into my office is I looked him in his eye and I started telling him who he really was. And when you get to a place where you can get on their level and feed them hope about who they are, I've seen tears run down this man's face. I've seen him have some sense of awakening about himself. And so I think with everything that we've experienced with these tragedies, I think it's important to go further than just the violence. We have to get to a place where we're understanding what is driving the violence. And that actually, those things happen before the violence ever happens. So we have to be in touch. We can't just yell at our youth. We can't just be upset at the violence. We're going to have to work.
Yes,
and work starts at the ground level of understanding where people are at and why they do things with guns that should not be done.
Thank you very much. Tony Morstetter is the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Bloomington Normal. He joins us from the guest microphone now. We just heard Alan talk about nothing for high school graduates, and that is where a lot of kids get lost. 5 out of the 7 recent fatalities, we understand, have been told that they were Boys and Girls Club clients at one time. Now, you can't save everybody, but do you see as well the lack of hope that Reverend Bennett talked about percolating into their minds the older they get?
Yes, I would agree, and that's something that we're strongly focused on, is not only working with our younger members or the youth in the community, but finding ways that we can help support our teenagers that are approaching that 18, 19, graduating from high school. You know, what are the next steps for them? Providing them the opportunities and experiences so that way their dreams are greater than just one thing. Everybody wanted to be a professional athlete, a police officer, a fireman. But if that dream doesn't happen, what else is out there for them? So we're looking at opportunities to build partnerships with the local trades and laborers. You know, we're looking at ways that we can train our junior staff and job shadow some of the corporations, some of the businesses, and make those partnerships with the different agencies and strength in our community where there are options for them once they reach adulthood.
Chief Bleichner, how do you see the juvenile crime level feeding into this? By the time they hit the juvenile system, are they gone, or can they be rescued or helped to evade the life and put into programs that like Tony operates?
No, I think there's always hope. I think that's what the juvenile programs are for. That's what juvenile courts set up to do, the juvenile system. I will say, though, there are individuals that take advantage of that. That there are individuals that may be 16 years old, but they're taking advantage of it because they know if they get caught doing certain things that the repercussions are, chances are, they're going to be released back to mom and dad, grandma, or whoever, and there's not that ultimate accountability there. So I have some mixed feelings because, in general, I think that juvenile justice system is meant to rehabilitate, to give those kids the benefit of the doubt, to encourage them so that they don't have some kind of a, weight on their shoulder when they get to be adults and go out into the world that holds them down. But there are also other individuals that operate, they act like adults, they commit crimes like adults, and they need to be punished like adults and held accountable for those kind of things.
Once they have those adult records, though, they are lost because they are no longer really employable.
True. I wouldn't say they're lost. And in those cases, like I said, never give up hope. But we're happy to be at the table. We're happy to be at the table and have these discussions because law enforcement is a critical part of this. We're not the only part to this. Thousands of people have had different interactions with individuals that commit crime, individuals who are victims. And a lot of decisions bring them to wherever that particular focal point was. And thousands of people have had opportunities to impact and interact with those individuals before we ever come into contact with them. And a lot of them have very good intentions, and sometimes it's successful, sometimes it isn't. At risk truly means that they're at risk any given time. Something could happen that takes them in a certain direction that is potentially dangerous to them. And so for us in law enforcement, again, we want to try and identify those individuals, the individuals who have potential, hope, opportunity. But we also, there's no community policing program when people are getting shot and getting killed. There's no community policing program that's effective at the barrel of a gun. They've got to put the guns down. They've got to stop the violence, and then we can come together and talk. That's what we need to do. If they won't put the guns down, if they won't stop the violence, for public safety, we have to identify, we have to suppress, and we have to remove those individuals for the safety of the community. Please, that was my plea. Put down the guns. Stop the violence. Let's all work together in that.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker, moderating a community conversation about gun violence. One of the relatives of one of the victims on the Orchard Road killings remarked that she grew up on the rough side of Chicago, and yet it's qualitatively different now, even in Bloomington Normal and certainly in Chicago, than it was when she grew up, because there was a sense of neighborhood, a sense of community. The grandmothers all looked out for all the kids, and that sense of cohesion is no longer there. Would the panelists agree or disagree with that? And what's to be done if you do agree?
I agree to a certain extent. To be honest, on that level, it is, you say, the grandmothers or whatnot, that's a lot of kids that this happens to come from broken homes. You got to think about that. They come from broken homes. Another thing with gun violence is this new era of kids that we're dealing with is different from our era. See, that's where I come in at, because not to go back a little bit, but to your point, it is hope for them. I'm an ex-knucklehead, literally. I'm the same streets that I'm trying to change on was the same streets that caused me troubles in my life. I took the wrong road starting out. 17, I was in prison starting out. But since then, I've done tremendous amounts of things to kind of pacify my criminal history. I had a nice, strong criminal history, so I had to find all the types of programs that'll work for me. I had to go to college, but I had to fight to go to college because by me having a drug offense, I wasn't able to get financial aid because I had a drug offense. But a murderer could, but I couldn't, but I had a drug offense. So I had to go through drug counseling. I had to do this. I had so many hoops to jump through just to become the person that I am today. So actually, to be honest, I'm one of them success stories that actually prison changed me, to be quite honest with you. So I never thought I'd be sitting at this panel with none of them. Literally, never a day in my life. Definitely next to the chief of police. True story. Yeah. So it's hope for anybody.
Because of those hurdles, it's hard to give you hope. It's hard to give that young man in your office, Reverend, hope. How many others are not able to surmount a record, and what can be done for them? We've heard talk about apprenticeship programs, but those too have some limits, don't they?
Yeah, and it should not be hard for us to speak hope now to people, because the reality of the matter is, and even going back to your last question, is there is very much so a breakdown of relationships, especially in community. And we need to understand how important this is to gun violence, looking out for one another, right? You live by your neighbor, but you don't talk to your neighbor. I was even talking to my church about this recently, that we don't even have family dinners anymore. All this stuff, it starts in the home. It doesn't end there, but it does start there. It starts in the home. I go to restaurants, and I see families sitting at restaurants, and everybody's on their phone. Everybody's on Facebook. And the reason I say this, that it's important with relationship, because it's going to take more than telling these youth and young adults, and even adults, it's going to take more than telling them put the guns down. Mm-hmm. If it was that easy, they would have never picked them up. It's going to take relationship. And we cannot be afraid to talk. We cannot be afraid to deal with. And when they do, it makes it harder when they get a record. And I do agree with the chief. When you commit certain type of these violent crimes, you do deserve consequences. You do deserve to be punished. When you take a life, it should not just be okay, it's okay, we understand. Absolutely not. So, but we do have to also understand, a lot of these kids, like I said, they have records, they don't have hope. And we have to get them jobs. We have to get them different economic stability, education. We have to push these things. And I think it really starts at the ground level, in the home first, in our education, get them jobs, focus on community policing, right? We have to rebuild relationships within our community. And I think we'll find that things can begin to get better when we're not afraid to communicate with each other and to communicate with those who we ultimately want to help.
Indeed. I had it. Just
Chief Blechner, yes.
Just to follow up on a couple of those comments, because I would agree. I think one of the things we see and our officers see when they run across individuals, and I'm talking in this case youth a lot of times, 11 o'clock at night, 2 o'clock in the morning, kids, and when our officers encounter them and they go to take them home, the sad thing in some cases is nobody's looking for them. And I say that it's sad because whether that's, a mom, a dad, an uncle, a grandma, a pastor, somebody who's a mentor, somebody who instills hope in those kids is a big part of it. Somebody who's willing to make decisions and tell them what's in their best interest, not based on whether they were going to be friends on Facebook when it's all said and done, but because it's in that individual's best interest for their health and safety. And that's what is missing sometimes. And I'm not talking, again, we're talking generalities up here because every situation is different, but we see that more and more is that caring adult, that consistent thing is missing from a lot of those kids' lives.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Politicians have suggested better reporting of mental illness information to a federal background check system. When that was tried in Connecticut, it was successful at keeping guns from the mentally ill, but it reduced crime by less than 1%. Should we be targeting drug possession and alcohol violations as a disqualifier for gun ownership instead of just mental health? Mental health is a quick out on gun ownership. Karen?
Well, for Moms Demand Action, our philosophy is to distinguish between mental health challenges and dangerous mental health challenges, because to say that mentally ill people should not have access to licensed guns is kind of painting with a very broad brush, but we know that there are dangerously mental ill people that should be not allowed to have guns. And I wanted to talk a little bit about when we were talking about how young people nowadays seem to have more access to guns, and everybody wants a gun, and they seem to be able to get the guns. It did make me want to swing around just a moment to talk about one of the things that we're working on is a bill 337 in the Senate that has bipartisan House and Senate support, but it's the one that used to be called like closing the gun show loopholes, and now it's more closing gun sale loopholes, because we know that internet sales is a place that is readily available to buy guns. And I know that Senator Don Harmon from Oak Park had made a point, a very good point, I thought, in saying we need to be looking out, trying to find the gap in the chain of commerce. And it's often that first sale of the gun to the public that starts that chain to allowing it to get into the hands of somebody that shouldn't have it, because we aren't able to identify through background checks or through waiting periods or appropriate ones or sensible ones. And so I just wanted to say that that's one of the ways we see a loophole that's allowing a lot of guns to be circulating, and we know what happens with those.
This is a community conversation about gun violence in Bloomington, Normal, and Central Illinois. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and this is GLT. Chief Bleichner, you wanted to break in there?
No, I was just going to follow up a little bit, I think, on some of the comments about the gun legislation and the loopholes and closing those. And I think it's a combination of things. I'm not opposed to some way, shape, or form dovetailing in the mental health databases into cross-reference checking, because I think if you've got somebody who's homicidal, suicidal, making threats, whatever diagnosis you put on it, if somebody has deemed that individual is making threats against themselves or other, then you need to reconsider that, and that needs to be evaluated when they're looking to get a gun. One of the things from what we're seeing, though, is that you know, there's a host of gun laws out there right now, and I'm not demeaning it, because all of us come together. We want to do something. We want to help. We want to think that our legislators come together, and we think that the action, or the appropriate action, is another law. These guns that are out on the street, many of the individuals that have them, they don't care about the laws. They don't care. And I don't mean that in a negative, in a way to sound that they're dismissive, but it's become a way of life. That's what they use. It's like money. That's what they use to barter. That's what they use to get things with. That's what they use to trade those things with. And whether they're stolen or whether they're legitimate or what, that's how those things get into the hands of individuals. It's not somebody who's buying a gun on the internet that has to go to a federal firearms license dealer to get their background check done, where we're seeing the problem. I'm not saying it won't make a difference, because anything that does cut down on that, I'm certainly willing to consider and I'm for, but it's the individuals who can't legally possess guns. They go around it and they do it in an illegal way, and we're not even seeing individuals who are associates who can legally possess them going somewhere and doing what we call straw purchases and then transferring them. Majority of them are just ones that are being stolen, that are on the street now. There's enough of them out there that they're being transferred back and forth illegally.
This sounds like a good time to hear from audience member Kristen Clegg, if she could come up and talk about that. One of the victim's moms that GLT talked to asked, where are they getting all these guns? It baffles me. And as the chief just noted, a lot of them are stolen. Kristen, what's your question?
I'd just like to say that more than 237,000 guns were reported stolen in 2016. That has only accelerated. As you know, there are even more than that, millions. 2 million weapons were stolen over the last decade. There are absolutely no federal child access prevention laws, no federal laws to prevent kids from getting their hands on guns in a home. So if a parent leaves a gun accessible, their kid can get that gun. Only 9 states at the state level require firearm owners to report the loss or theft of any firearms to law enforcement. Illinois is one of those 9 states. However, our neighboring states do not. So if we have Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa all around us, a gun is stolen in one of those states, it comes over here, ends up in Chicago, or down here. It is a fact that stolen guns cross state borders. So I'd just like to say, as we've been talking about all evening, in October of 2017, our own McLean County State's Attorney, Jason Chambers, said, for me, the concern I have is not the increase in amount of gun crimes in Bloomington Normal, it's the lowering of the age of people I see with guns committing the crimes. It's children. Chambers went on to say, when you're talking about 15 and 16-year-olds running around with stolen handguns, that's a problem. Police arrested a 17-year-old male in connection with the Wednesday, April 27th fatal shooting at Lancaster Heights. Killed in that gunfire were Joseph Gardner, 20 years old, and Reginald Hart Jr., 19. The gunman was 17 years old. It is my opinion that stolen guns used in crimes and murders should be traced back to the original legal purchaser and owner, and the legal owner, the onus should be forced to face the consequences and charged for not properly securing their firearms. In a high percentage of cases, guns are stolen during break-ins to vehicles, bedroom nightstands, under mattresses, beds, closets, shoeboxes, and other improper and unsecured places to
Kristen,
store guns.
Okay, Kristen, thank you for your question.
You're welcome.
Chief, is there an economical or socially, a low social cost, an acceptable social cost way to trace guns that are stolen and to hold owners accountable for that in some fashion?
You can trace those guns as long as they were purchased after somewhere in the 1950s when they started the national database and registering the firearms and such. You can trace them back to the point of purchase. In Illinois, if you transfer one as a individual gun owner, you're required to document that. You're required to run the individual through the FOID database on the state police website. Like I said, a lot of what we're seeing is those guns, as she mentioned, they're coming up stolen. They're coming up stolen in burglaries and vehicle burglaries, and they're taken from locations, storage units, and things like that. And then after that, so if you have somebody who's the victim of it, and we could have some law that makes them accountable. I'm always one who supports it. You know, it's like anything else. If I've got a $3,000 laptop, if I don't want it to walk away, I'm going to lock it up. I've never come home and found my firearms doing something they shouldn't do when they're under lock and key. If you've got the money to buy them, I think you should be, it's morally responsible to lock them up. So that's just my thought on that. Now, again, there's a big difference between somebody keeping them lawfully in their house and an individual making a choice to break into their residence, commit a forcible felony, and take them from them. That's part of what this devaluing human life and other things, what goes to in the culture is, sometimes individuals want what you have and they will do whatever they need to get it because they think that they need it, they want it. And I would love for everybody to do it a cost-effective way. Yes, we can trace them back. It's up to the legislators if they want to have that where there's additional penalties for individuals that don't secure them.
Audience
can
member.
Can I just add to that real quick?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, to be honest, where I come from, parents don't hold guns. They don't. Most people that I know that I deal with on a regular basis, the kids that I deal with on a regular basis, the parents don't have no gun. Some half the parents may be felons, and they're scared of the gun themselves. So you got to think it on all standpoint. It's not just the parent that the problem Some of them don't have guns. Some of them is not going to get it from their mom or dad lockbox. Nine times out of 10, they got it from one of their friends, they got it from one of their friends, they got it from one of their friends, and they got it from one of their friends. Nine times out of 10 is how it happens. Only speaking of how guns have came into people's lives that I know, it's been in that form. It's never been nobody, that, I don't know anybody, none of my friends' kids gonna go up to purchase a gun from somewhere, no. Not from maybe on the streets, yes, but that gun didn't come out of no lockbox. That gun didn't come out of the grandma's house. No, the gun came from one of their friends that got it from one of their friends one way or another. But like, for instance, the kids that's taking place that passed in these tragic events, their parents weren't gun owners, I guarantee you. Nine times out of 10, they wasn't. Them guns came from the streets. So on my standpoint, I'm down for lockboxes or whatnot with guns or whatnot, but it's not coming from that place with this time.
Karen Irvin, let's talk about what your organization is proposing to limit stolen guns or to get a handle on that problem in the United States.
Well, I don't know that there is anything other than what I've talked about with legislation. I mean, we have a very single-minded mission to create more sensible gun laws. So, knowing that it's a complicated problem, like Alan was just talking about, that guns that are on the street, guns that get traded or passed along, they have to come from somewhere. And so we know that looking at the first chain in the first link in the commerce chain, it had to be sold to someone and then sold to someone else and sold to someone else. And so our angle is to try to work towards the legislation that will help identify the guns, stop the sale of them without proper background checks. I know I'm saying things that Chief Fleischner has kind of said are in place and ineffective. So if we look at that realistically and say laws that we have in place are kind of ineffective, we need to be creative and figure out at least another way to start. We, as Moms Demand Action, really are in that lane of legislation, and so trying to keep guns out of 14-year-old hands, we're going about it the way we know how.
Thanks, Karen. We would be remiss if we did not address gangs as part of the gun violence problem. Gangs are not just economic, they're social organizations. However dysfunctional, they create a sense of family, they create a sense of community, they create a common culture, and yet they are terribly, terribly unhealthy. How should we attack the attractiveness of gangs to those kids in their mid to upper teen years who no longer have hope?
Oh, I'll definitely address this.
All right. All righty, Alan.
On that standpoint, first and foremost, it's not really gangs anymore. There's no such thing as a gang anymore, because they're not gangs. They're cliques. They're friends, the friends of friends. Most of them may be at one point in time in a certain gang, but their friends are not in the same gang that they're in. Nine times out of 10, it's friends. All of these kids grew up together, what people are failing to realize. Bloomington Normal is so small, so small. These kids grew up together. They played football against each other. They had local neighborhood fights against each other, whether it was play fights or real fights. These are the same kids that cohabitated with each other, eating at the same lunch table. That's what everybody got to realize. This wasn't a gang issue on this standpoint. This was a money issue. These are money issues. These are greed issues. These are the issues that this had nothing to do with any gangs. And once again, gangs is not even relevant anymore. You can't even say what a Blackstone was or GD was, because they're not that anymore. It's about what this clique is, and this clique represents that whatever may be about money. It's about rap groups. They don't have gangs anymore. They have cliques.
Go ahead, yeah, Reverend.
I would I think one thing we also have to do in regards to the nature of the question you just asked is I just believe we really have to change the narrative. Even kind of in hearing the question that you asked when you associated the word gang and then you associated maybe possibly some good qualities that it could have, family, and see that's a lie we've been sold.
Yes.
That's a lie our generation, our children, our culture, and a lot of African American children have been sold that gang culture is family. That's not the definition of family. If family does not lead you to a place where you can end up in prison, family doesn't put past an illegal gun in your hand, family doesn't put illegal drugs in your hand, that's not what family does. And I'm tired of our youth and our children being lied to. And it's not just a Bloomington normal problem. It is a culture that has been sold to our youth. Every time they turn on the television and the rappers they see, the rappers make guns look cool. The rappers make drugs look cool. You know, on Facebook, like it's so many lies that we have to change the narrative, and we have to reinstill in the minds of our young people what true family means. We have to get the word gang out of their mind. We have to get, your hands weren't used to make signs. Unless you're using sign language, right? Like but we've been lied and we need to get them jobs and we need to train them so they don't have to feel like they have to do certain things to make fast money. We need to reteach them that to make the living the right way and that it's okay. And we need to make that cool. We need to make being a father to your children cool. We need to make being a parent or a mother cool. We need to make school cool again. And that's going to take us not shining a light on gang culture, not shining a light on cliques. We have to shine a light on the right things. Exactly. If you don't shine a light on the right things, then you can't complain if they stay in the dark.
Yes.
Let me ask Chris Collins and Mike Matika to come to the mic in just a second here. No, come on up, because when we get to you, we'll get to you fairly quickly. How can that question be addressed? How can those positives of what you've outlaid as laid out as traditional virtues be given the cultural primacy that they deserve?
Well, like I said, it really starts in the home. We have to go back to the home. That's where the first interaction, the first level of teaching, the first level of training, it has to start in a home. Chief kind of spoke to it. If the police are bringing home a young person on curfew and there's no one to go home to or no one really looking for them, that's a problem, mm-hmm. right? And our kids can get lost in situations like that. But that's where I go back to the beginning. It takes everybody. It takes everybody pouring in and, like I said, speaking to those things. I found out that when I have the opportunity to speak to our young people and really don't start out pointing my finger at them, but start making them feel like I am here to help and understand them yes. and not just talk, but let them talk, right? And then see where they're really at. We can begin to just and it takes time, guys. It's a process. It's not an overnight thing. It's not like a one-time, hey, stop doing this type of thing. When you've allowed them to live in generational cultures, it takes generational teaching and learning and jobs and all of those things. But I think we have to put it before them and give them hope and show them that it can be done. And then people like Alan, even, who have been there, done that street life, and came out, you're really the biggest voice because they need to see that, hey, I've been there, there ain't nothing good in them streets, but you can make it out and you can, you know, live successfully.
Tony Morstetter of the Boys and Girls Club, would you talk briefly how your programs serve that function that Reverend Bennett has just laid out?
Well, that's one thing that all of our staff strive to do is to make those positive, supportive relationships with not only our members, but our families as well. As we had mentioned today, it's not just one person. We all have to work together as a community and provide them those opportunities. Maybe they're not going to listen to me. Maybe they're not, the message that I share with them is not going to resonate with them. But maybe the next person or the next staff or their neighbor or somebody else that they run into that has that positive message, it'll resonate with them. So we all have to work together to share that same common message.
Tony's programs start to try to find apprenticeships and the next step beyond the high school years. Chris Collins, what do you have to say about that gap that we early on identified in the lives of young people?
That's the thing. We have to start young. And we've got, it takes a village. I heard that many times. It takes a village to raise our children. The thing is we all have to raise our children. It doesn't matter what race, color, creed, or religion you come from. That doesn't matter as long as you're getting right values put in your face. The one thing we're not giving our children are opportunities. Like he was saying, they turn 18 to 21, they're kind of lost in there. I'm working with him and trying to get these trades programs set up so we can work with the Boys and Girls Club throughout America. We want to be able to do this in every city across America. We want to be able to work with every prison across America, because we have so many thousands of prisoners that go in and they have no home to parole out to. So they sit there and they do the full time. Well, why don't we take those parolee times, we put them in a program. When they come out of prison, they're actually homeowners. They have a job. They're not looking for one. They are one. They are a reason we are fixing things. Now, we can take and not do anything.
Give us the title of your program, too.
It's actually called Hope.
Okay. And how many people does it serve? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, I've been working on it for 13 years. Built a home in 2011 out of recycled cars from Hurricane Katrina. It's here in Bloomington, by the way. Congress did write a letter to Obama and his administration about the house because it was built with no dumpster. You know, that's a big problem. But if we could take the guns out of kids' hands and put screw guns in them, we could build steel-framed homes.
So how can your program hire groups like yours, hire kids who need to be busy? What's the capacity?
High school students, through their occupational centers, we need to be able to offer them more than cutting hair and framing a door frame. That was something that was said to me from a director of a high school. And they were failing them because they're not teaching them. They're not giving them the future that they need to have. We can actually teach them to recover and rebuild every natural disaster on the planet and fix the problems that the cities had prior to it and never use another tree to do it. We didn't buy anything from any other country. We stood up as a United States and become united for one thing, and that's to have peace on earth and everyone have a safe shelter to live in. When our kids have somewhere safe to go home to, their life is going to be different. When those kids start changing people's lives and taking the suffering away from them, their lives are going to be different. It'll be changed from the first time it's said, and it'll be changed when it's 100 times. But they could change lives on a daily basis just by moving forward as a group.
Thanks very much. Mike Matika, that's Chris Collins of Bloomington, about a program called Hope. Mike Matika is a longtime community leader in Bloomington Normal. You had something you wanted to add to the potential to fill those gaps for kids who are on the edge.
Thank you, Charlie. And with me tonight here, I want to recognize Dave Taylor from United Way, something Reverend Bennett and Chief Bleichner, we've talked about, both mayors are endorsing this. I'd like to invite people to put August 18th on their calendar for a community youth summit to bring together business, neighborhood organizations, churches, education, and start to look not just for a one-day meeting, but start a dialogue on some long-term issues, from mental health to our grade schools to young kids, all the way through the young adults that Mr. Chambers talked about. So we'll be making a formal announcement soon, but just want folks to mark August 18 on your calendar to start pulling together the community for not just one day, but for some long-term discussion on working together, sponsored by United Way and Not in Our Town. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Dominique Stevenson, would you approach the mic? Let me ask the question. You know, there are 308 shootings, 86 deaths every day in this country from gun violence, according to the CDC. So the cases that we hear about in the news are highly selective and not representative. Let's talk about media coverage. What can reporters do better before and after the violence? And I think I'd like every member of the panel to tackle that one, starting with Reverend Bennett.
Well, can the media do better after and before? Before, I guess I could say we can highlight, like I was saying, spread the light on some good things. All of our young people and young adults, everybody's not doing the bad thing, and some have already turned over their lives, and it would be good to see that, and maybe that would encourage some of the ones who haven't yet turned over their life or who are thinking about doing something bad. It makes it a little bit easier when you can, you know, see that. So I think if to cover the bad is okay, but to cover the bad and not shed much light on the good is not. To go in for the media to go in and cover agencies that are here to help, you know, to cover them and put a spotlight. I know a lot of parents come up to me, they don't know what to do in our community. I don't know where to turn because they don't know about many of the programs. So to highlight those things would be good. And just after, I would just say, as far as media is concerned, cover the event fair and accurately. You know, don't have any biasness to it. Not to say that you do, but just saying, I would say after a tragedy has happened, cover it fair and accurate, but always even be thinking about the victims. You know, mm-hmm. don't just, you know, some things you might not need to cover, even if there's an investigation still going on. There's some things you might need to wait out, but media may not always want to do that. So,
Chief Leishner.
Now, I would agree. I think beforehand, I mean, just spotlighting the opportunities, success stories and the opportunities that are out there. And then, you know, obviously you need to cover the events when they happen and then follow up to that and then how it's covered. I would just say that, you know, fair and accurately covering it. And in some cases I've seen it, you know, and it's across the board is sometimes there's certain dialogue that's used that from my standpoint can be seen to maybe inflame or incite. And I would just ask you to be cautious and thoughtful of that when you're putting the stories together as to not do that and just be conscious about it.
Community Leader Alan Chambers, what's your thought on the media's role in this?
I agree with the chief as well as Mr. Bennett, Pastor Bennett. Mainly cover the right stuff. Don't pinpoint when you do cover a story, don't look for the bad in the situation. Every situation got a light. There's no need to drag a person through the mud that's going through something tough already, never knowing the outcome of how it affects the family. Certain questions with the media shouldn't be asked to a family, especially, for instance, do you know why it happened? No. If we knew why it happened, then we wouldn't be in this situation. But that's one of the things that they do. They pinpoint, and they don't pinpoint the key points. And like Pastor said, the key points is glorified, not to safeless plug, but people like me, to be honest, programs like the pastor runs. I knew nothing. I've been knowing the pastor my whole life. I knew he was a pastor at the City of Refuge. Did I know the programs that he was running? No. For the simple fact, it's not broadcasted, but I definitely can tell you how many shootings that take place in Bloomington. But I can definitely tell you, I can tell you when the Brugler starts. But I can't tell you about a program that's going to help our youth.
And Karen Irvin.
Well, I would commend the media, GLT, right now for this kind of coverage, mm-hmm. because I know that we get a lot of coverage when kids are outraged, as they should be, when there's been some sort of a mass shooting, and there's a lot nationally coverage of that. But we realize that most of the 96 deaths that happen each day are not because of mass shootings. They are individuals that are killing each other. And so we need to focus on the reality of that, not wait for the next mass shooting and then have people outraged for a short time. But this is ongoing.
Thank you, Karen. Let's turn to Dominique Stevens of Bloomington for his question.
How you doing? This is where I grew up, Bloomington, and I know pretty much everybody that's been involved in these things, and things have been festering for years, you know, because like Alan stated, that a lot of these people grew up together. What do we think we can do with the, how obsessed people are with pop culture, how is desensitizing the youth, and we're in a generation right now where trolling is what's really popular. So for people that don't know what trolling is, trolling is when somebody does something very crazy, they get it on camera, and they put it online just to draw more attention to themselves. Or they might say, like, forget this person, with much more colorful language, just to bring attention to them and they don't even know the person, they don't even dislike the person. It's just something they do to draw attention to them. And that's the generation that we're in right now with all the young people, is what can I do to draw attention to me, period, at any cost? I think those things need to be addressed because, you know, gun violence is attached to all of that. And what I mean by that is I'm a hip-hop artist. So I go to these different events, open mics, whatever the case might be, and I see everything firsthand for how people respond to the negativity, how they enjoy the crazy lyrics, how they're just thinking of more crazy ways to talk. And I know a lot of these people that are rapping in town, half of them have not really lived that lifestyle at all, but that kind of music is popping right now. People are getting paid off of that kind of music. And that's one of the things I mean by obsessed with pop culture.
Yeah, Dominic, thanks much for your question. Let's let Chief Bleichner talk about trolling and the level of conflict that social media can bring.
Good luck, Chief.
Yeah. I mean, just spinning off that a little bit is, you know, there's a lot of benefits to social media out there. That's one of the downfalls. You know, 20 years ago, you had a fight, you had an argument, it was contained, you were talking with your friends, you know, you said something bad about somebody in the heat of a moment, well, word may get back to them, it may not. Now it's on Snapchat, it's on video, it's put out there for everybody to see, so people are instantly humiliated out there. And we have become so, as a culture, so personal with our attacks on things. And so when you do that now, and before it wasn't just, you know, three or four of us sitting around talking and I'm talking bad about somebody. No, it's out there for hundreds and thousands of people to see, and then people feel that they've got to respond to that, and then things get escalated, and you're, you know, now you're one-upping, and you're one-upping, and the next thing you know, violence spills out. And that's the kind of thing that is the bad side of social media, if you will, when people utilize it that way. And unfortunately, I don't have a great answer for it, but we do see that very frequently.
Young people are not good self-regulators of whatever culture
they're in. I will tell you that young people get a bad rap, but old people, my age... Yeah. I've seen them that aren't good at it.
Literally.
They do stuff out there and say stuff that they shouldn't be saying or doing. It's amazing they think that it's because it's on Facebook, it's private, and they've got the right to do it. And how about the civility that we should have in our conversations and how we're treating people?
Do other panelists want to tackle that way to step back from the coarseness that our society has now?
Of course, I definitely want to talk about the YouTube babies. That's what I like to call them, because that's what they are. They're the thing is how to prevent it, and that's idle time. Idle time gives you time to do everything. You can't be on Facebook trolling if you didn't work 12 hours and my chef just hit me. My feet hurt so bad, so I can't go trolling. That's the point that we need to figure out. How do we replace trolling with that job opportunity? How to replace the gun with that job opportunity? Once again, people only do bad things because sometimes they have no other choice. If your rent's due, the kid's crying, your baby need new shoes, he's been walking on the floor for the last 5 days, then you're gonna do whatever you need to do to make that happen. So if I can produce you with an opportunity to say, look, check this out, I know you're going through some things, it's gonna take time. What you gotta do is let them know that this is not a quick process. I hustle every day. I am a true, natural-born hustler, but I don't hustle through streetwise. You will see me hustling through and giving you a flyer. I might be that dude that you're going to be like, I am tired of seeing this flyer of this restaurant. But what I'm saying is you got to give them another hustle. You have to replace, if you're taking away a hustle, you have to replace it with another one. If you're going to take this gun out of my hands, please give me a job placement to do that. I'll give it to you. 9 times out of 10, if you tell this kid, look, man, I'm gonna save you. I can't save everybody, but you, I'm gonna save you, and I'm gonna give you this job if you just give me the gun that you've been carrying for the last 3 days. Give me the drugs out your pocket. But then I'm liable for possession, Chief. If that happened, don't hold me for possession. I'm gonna call you. Hey, Chief, I got
Thank
the drugs.
You.
But what I'm saying is you have to give them something different. You can't say, well, I'm just gonna chastise you and take this away from you. No, you finna fight. Now you got a problem with this kid because you about to take what he's gotten from somebody else 9 times out of 10. He owes this person for what you about to take from him. No, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna take this from you, but I'm gonna give you this opportunity. Now, if I can get this opportunity, then this got to go because you can't mix the two with me. So that's the point that we need local business owners. It's too many businesses that's local in town that can help us stop this gun problem. And 9 times out of 10, the people that I know, if you give them a better way, they going to take it.
Alan Chambers, thank you very much. We've come to the end of our time in this community conversation about gun violence. I'd like to thank our panelists, William Bennett from the City of Refuge Ministries, the Reverend, who's also a member of the Bloomington Public Safety and Community Relations Board, Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner, Karen Irvin of the Twin Cities Chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and community leader Alan Chambers. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal, made possible by listeners like you.